Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here, and I'm joined, as I usually am, by my two other co-hosts. Let's say hello. He is the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com. Please welcome Alex Marcus. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Justin. How's it going?
Going pretty well. Glad to be back with you. And we are also here with our other esteemed co-host. He is the co-host of the Pod on the Rooftops, a Genesis podcast with yours truly, Noah France. Hello, Noah.
Hey, not only am I a podcast co-host, I'm also a winner.
Well, we certainly hope. Well, we are here, as we usually are. For those who don't know, on our podcast, this is a podcast where we tend to discuss a recent movie release and then a broader topic related to that movie release. But today we're going to be doing something a little bit different, namely paying off a bet, because every year we do a wager on the on our picks for the Oscars, and whoever wins, whoever gets the most picks correct, gets to pick a movie for us to discuss on the podcast. And Alex has won, I have won, and Noah has just recently won. And
winner!
As a result, he has picked a movie for us to discuss, which is Amadeus from 1984. So we will be getting into that. Noah will be discussing what it's meant to him. He has done a lot of research and has a lot of things to ask us, I'm sure.
Well, some research.
Some
a moderate research. Amount.
Okay, yeah.
A lot for Noah.
Yes. Indeed. Yes. I'm very excited to do this film with you guys. Now, some of you may be wondering, how exactly did Noah win the Oscar bet? Well, obviously, it's because of my superior knowledge of cinema history and Oscar voting history.
Well, no, that goes without saying.
That's not true. It's because I picked Sound of Metal to win Best Editing, and I was the only one who did. That's the reason. I haven't even seen Sound of Metal yet.
We were very close in the bracket this year.
Yeah. But we will be getting into all of that. But to begin, we're going to start the way we usually do with our first disclosure segment, which is a segment in which we talk about what we've been watching recently, apart from the main review that we're doing. So I thought we'd start this time. Let's start with you, Alex. What's been good for you recently?
Okay, so recently I haven't been watching as many films as I might like, but that's because I've been catching up on a lot of really excellent spring television. And I wanted to briefly talk about two shows that I think our listeners would really like to hear about. One of them I'm sure that they've heard before, and one of them I'm not sure. So I think that I'm very excited to talk about them. The first is a show that has been on the lips of a lot of people, especially in the nerd community, and that is an Amazon original series called Invincible. Show is adapted from a Robert Kirkman comic book series. Robert Kirkman, you might know as the creator of the Walking Dead comics as well. He is front and center in the creative team here. He's kind of the creator of the show and running the writer's room over there. And he's assembled an incredible cast, just truly stacked cast of people, and led by Steven Yeun, who, of course, everyone fell in love with this year in Minari, Sandra Oh, who I'm a big fan of, J.K. Simmons, who doesn't like J.K. Simmons, Zazie Beetz from Atlanta and Deadpool 2, Walton Goggins, Gillian Jacobs, Zachary Quinto, Andrew Reynolds, Jason Mantzoukas, just like an incredible Mark Hamill is there also in a kind of really interestingly understated role. Mahershala Ali, John Hamm, like Seth Rogen. It's just an incredible, incredible voice cast. And they do an excellent job. This is an animated series about a teen superhero whose dad is basically like an analog to Superman, and he has kind of similar powers to Superman as well, but his storyline is more of a Spider-Man kind. He's like a teenager trying to balance these new powers with being like in high school and having a girlfriend and all that stuff. But the twist is that his dad is kind of this world Superman, and spoiler alert, he is not as altruistic as you might think he is. This show has gotten a lot of headlines for being extremely violent, and it certainly is in points very violent, and that's not typically something that I care a lot about. But what's interesting about this show is that it really earns the violence in the episodes in which it features, because it really focuses on how just powerful these beings are and the impact of what a punch is and the punishment that our lead character sometimes is forced to endure. And it really has a storytelling utility to it that helps create like an emotional tapestry and makes the world feel more vibrant and vivid. So I initially was resistant to checking this out, partially because of that reputation of, oh, it's so gory, it's so bloody, whatever. And also that it's a 45-minute cartoon, right? Which is kind of like, all right, like that's a lot for just an animated show every week. But I just devoured this thing over a weekend, and I think it's just really, really great, fun comic book storytelling with a really mature emotional core that I was really impressed by. Have either of you guys checked this out yet?
Not yet. Surprise, surprise. I'm not up to date on TV.
I have not, but I definitely had some of the same reservations that you have some of the same reservations that you had before you watched the show. Yeah, I think like part of it was the violence and just also just like, do I want to watch a Robert Kirkman production? Like, I don't know if he's really for me. But yeah, I have heard good things. And so your opinion is the latest good opinion about the show that I've heard. Yeah, I'd be curious to check it out. I anytime J.K. Simmons, you know, obviously I love him as an actor, no matter what he's doing, but especially as a voice actor, I have a particular fondness for him.
And this part is just it's just a bouquet of delectable meals for him to chew on. So
your metaphors there.
It's so worth it though. It's really great. And he has, and basically it's like he plays the Superman dad kind of combo to Steven Yeun's Spider-Man Superboy son. And their mom, who is a human, is played by Sandra Oh. And she's just, is, and like, I'm familiar with Sandra Oh in a number of things, and I feel like she just loses herself in this part. It's such a departure for her in terms of how much more like quiet and understated her performance is here than I think in a lot of other, where she is usually tasked to kind of balance comedy and drama in a way that like few people can, and she does an excellent job. But here it's a departure for her in a way that I really liked. So yeah, I just have nothing but good things to say about this show. If you're a fan of any superhero media at all, I think you should really at least watch the first episode and give it a chance. Just know also it has kind of a weird sort of structure in that you think that an episode is over and like credits start to run, and then there can be as much as like 15 minutes more after that. So just like don't be quick on the dial when you're finishing up an episode. The other show that I wanted to talk about briefly is HBO Max's Hacks, which is created by Jen Statsy, Paul W. Downs, and Lucia Agnello. And it stars primarily Jean Smart as sort of a Joan Rivers type, stand-up comedy icon who's maybe a little bit past her prime, living in Vegas, having a very successful, if somewhat irrelevant, residency there. And the story is about her kind of ending up with a new writer and like slash assistant by the name of Ava, who's played by Hannah Einbender, who's a person that I'm not as familiar with as Jean Smart, who I of course adore. And it's kind of about these two, like the Ava character is this kind of indie alt comedy person who had a deal taken away from them because of an unfortunate tweet, and she's kind of down on her luck, and she gets kind of connected through her agent to the Jean Smart character, Deborah Vance, and they are an unlikely pair, and they definitely do not hit it off at first, but it definitely is one of these situations where these two kind of have to learn from each other and from each other's perspectives to become better people. And that sounds super schmaltzy and terrible, but it's actually really sweet and also incredibly funny and acidic at times. This is the team from Broad City. And also, more notably for our podcast, Rough Night, which is a movie that featured heavily in one of our summer preview episodes where I was like very excited for it. And then I watched it and I came back and was like, oh, God, I was wrong. So very happy to see them bounce back. And because this show is hilarious and it is the perfect kind of blend of tones and textures. And it's just so funny. And so smart, and just like Caitlin Olsen is there from Always Sunny. She plays Jean Smart's adult daughter. And Megan Stalter, who a lot of people might know from Twitter, is there as the agent's assistant. And she seals every scene that she's in by being terrible at her job. And yeah, it's just a really fun show. It's got like a very kind of throwbacky like mid-2000s prestige TV vibe where it's just about like two people, one very powerful actor and one person you're just getting to know for the first time. But I loved those shows and I'm so happy to get a chance to revisit that kind of like dramedy format in this new setting. So yeah, really, really strongly recommend Hacks. And it's a great showcase for Jean Smart, who's just excellent in everything, and she's having just an incredible series of years from... you know, from Fargo to Legion to Watchmen to now Mayor of Easttown, which is another show that is excellent that she's on, and now Hacks. She's just really having an incredible moment, and I'm just so happy for her because she deserves it. She's excellent.
Yeah, I think I maybe vaguely had heard of this show. I had no idea that the people behind Broad City were the ones who created it.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not as wacky and surreal as that show is, and I think that's a good thing for the content of the show. This is definitely much more grounded and much more lived in, and I think that's a nice departure for them. They're really showing a lot of range,
yeah,
being able to pull this off.
Well, I want to go to you next, Noah. Do you have something in the television medium, as Alex has talked about, or is it do you have something a little bit different?
I actually do. I have something in the television medium. So among the many, many things that I've been trying to like work through in terms of like going back and watching movies and shows is I have a whole list of older classic anime series that are all considered classics or seminal hits or hugely influential works, but that I've never actually taken the time to watch. And bit by bit, I'm working my way through that list very slowly. And a little while ago, I took the time to watch a series from the late 80s called Gunbuster. I know, Alex, I know you've heard of this show. Have you heard of it, Justin?
I have not heard of Gunbuster. What?
Wait, no, you have. We talked about this. This is a series that, this was a series that, among other people, was directed and produced by Hideaki Anno before he made Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Oh, okay, so it's an anime.
Yeah, it's an anime.
Gotcha.
And it's a 6-episode anime series that, like Neon Genesis, it's very much... Justin is in the process of watching Neon Genesis Evangelion for the first time, lovely listeners, and at some point he and I will do an episode in the show talking about that, because I really want to do it. But it was because Neon Genesis Evangelion had such an impact on me that I wanted to go back and watch Gunbuster. Because a lot of people refer to that as kind of, and it really is, it very much feels like a trial run for what Neon Genesis Evangelion later was, because Gunbuster, like Evangelion, is a, you know, it's a mecha suit anime where there is an alien race invading the galaxy, and for some reason is a threat to the human race, but the details, like where these aliens come from and what their purpose are, is kind of vague. And what's the human race to do? Of course, build giant mecha suits to go into space and fight the alien race and destroy them before they destroy the human race. And there is a lot of stuff in it that It's much shorter than Neon Genesis Evangelion. It's only 6 episodes of like 20, 25 minutes. I feel like you could take these episodes and remaster them and re-edit them together and just make like a 2.5-hour film, basically, because it kind of functions like that, even though it was an OVA. And there's a lot of the basic plot mechanisms, not just the surface level stuff, like there's an alien race threatening the human race, and we have these mecha suits to fight them. But a lot of the dynamics between these characters, you have these older mentor type figures who have their own agenda, and it's not clear why they take these fights against the aliens so personally. You have these rivalries and dynamics between the people who use the mecha suits. And, you know, you have these young, basically teenage girls who are the pilots for the mecha suits. But that, in a way, almost serves as like a metaphor for the emotional journeys that these characters undertake. So there are a lot of building blocks in Gunbuster where it feels like Anno took that and said, oh, OK, we did this in Gunbuster. Now I'm going to develop this further and like take it even farther in my next show. It is also that this does have to be said up front. The fan service, specifically like the sexualization and use of nudity for these young women / teenage characters, is much more explicit in Gunbuster than it is in Neon Genesis Evangelion. And there is much less self-awareness. Like, I do want to go into detail about this when Justin and I have the time to talk about Evangelion. I feel like the immaturity in Evangelion is part of the point, and that's worked into the fabric of the show. Here, it's much more clearly like, okay, in each episode, there's going to be at least one scene where there's, you know, titillating, like, side boob shots of these teenage girls while they're changing. It very much feels gratuitous, especially because, and I think that's unfortunate because I really find the emotional core of the show to be really well done. My first comment after I finished watching it, when I either wrote to you directly, Alex, or I wrote into our chat group on Signal, this show felt like what Chris Nolan wanted Interstellar to be. But what Interstellar ultimately did not...
this is that show. Okay.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, now Alex remembers. So Chris Nolan with Interstellar, he tried to do this big sci-fi adventure in space that plays with the concept, or that tried to realistically portray how the relativity of time could result in people going on this relatively short adventure in space while all their family and friends on Earth grow old and even die in their absence. And then these people come back to a completely different world and a completely different environment than the one that they left. And to go into the emotional aspect of that, like what would it do to a person to have that experience of, you know, going down, you know, having this going somewhere and then coming back and like, oh, holy shit, my childhood friend is like a grandma now or something like that. And most people felt that Interstellar didn't, like, Interstellar clearly wanted to do that and had that be the emotional core of the movie. Most audiences and most critics did not get that from Interstellar, but I think that really works really, really well in Gunbuster. Like, it really does capture, and I think part of the fact is the fact that it's animated, and I think it gives that a little bit more leeway to go a bit more over the top with some of the emotional moments with the characters, but still have it feel real. And much like with Neon Genesis Evangelion, the surface sci-fi gloss of, oh, we have these action scenes and we have this cool technology and there's this big, you know, literally unit like galaxy defining battle at the end, that's all less important than showing the impact that all this has on its main characters and how it affects their relationships to each other. And also being very direct and very clear about the cost that these people experience, like the very personal cost of losing all this time with friends and family. I really, you know, like I said, it's only 6 episodes. It's very short and very watchable. And it's pretty easy to find. I don't know if there are any, in air quotes, like official channels where it's available, because it is very old. But if you're able to find a way to watch, I really do recommend it, because I really felt that it succeeds a lot more emotionally than a lot of similar films and later films have tried to do, like Interstellar tried to do, but were not quite as successful at. Like it doesn't, it's towards the end, especially, it does not pull punches. And I had heard about how, like, a lot of old anime fans, like, still got emotional when talking about the show, like people who saw the show when they were a kid, when it first came out, and how it still, like, it emotionally resonates with them. And I totally get it. Like, if I'd seen this when I was a kid, it definitely would have been, like, it would have become an all-time favorite of mine. Yeah, I think it works very well as a companion piece to Neon Genesis Evangelion. There's a lot you can compare and contrast, even though Evangelion is much longer and has a lot more depth, ultimately, just because, you know, it's a longer show and they, you know, Anno could do more with the concept. But yeah, I'm really, really glad that I was made aware of this, the existence of this anime, and I'm really glad that I took the time to watch it. It was absolutely worth my time. And I highly recommend it to anyone who is in any way open to this type of mecha anime. I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, but I really think that even if it's not, I think this that a lot of people would really like this.
It's been interesting, not to get too off topic, but like, it's been interesting watching Evangelion, having seen some other later mech inspired animes, because it almost feels like he's reacting to probably stuff that was happening at the time, but even like unconsciously reacting to things that would come that might have even been inspired by Neon Genesis. So I guess I'm curious, with Gunbuster, do you feel like that's also kind of a response to maybe things at the time or even things that came later in anime?
I'm not enough of an expert. Like, I'm a huge enthusiast for anime, but I could never claim to be like an expert in individual anime artists or individual anime subgenres. So I don't want to say anything that's going to end up being wildly off base. But I do seek a lot of connective threads between the two works, where there are certain, I see how certain topics and certain ideas really clearly meant a lot to Anno, and how that very much became a definitive part of his creative approach to making anime.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to keep it going, not with an anime, but with an animated work.
Ooh, specifically, three for three.
An animated film that is called Morona's Fantastic Tale, which I saw recently. This is a French animated film from Anca Damian, who is a Romanian director who has mostly worked in live action, as far as I could tell. So this is maybe a bit of a departure for her, but watching it, I think you would think, oh, this person has like been making animated films all of her life. Like, it just has the feel of a real seasoned master. And I especially wanted to bring it up because anytime I see an animated film that I think really explores the potential of the medium, I feel like I have to tell Noah about it, just because I know he's such a champion for animation, and rightfully so. This is a movie I have to confess I heard about because a critic I follow, who I also know both Alex and Noah are big fans of, Matt Zoller-Seitz. Was one of his top 10 films of the year. Actually, I believe it was his number three.
So, which year was it?
T- 2020.
Oh, from last year. Okay.
Yeah. So I keep I'm so locked into 2020 movies right now. I keep forgetting that it's like, oh,
6 months into the next.
Yeah. So he was a big fan. His review of it is really fantastic. So that was kind of how I first heard of it, and I just was like, what is this movie? And I looked it up, and I was like, really digging me at this style of it. The fact that it's told from a dog's perspective, so I should say Morona is a dog, and that's one of just many names she has, because she has many different owners throughout the course of her relatively short life. And this is a film where we're basically at the very, it's sort of framed as this sort of retrospective of her life. As she's like, and this isn't a huge spoiler because it's the very beginning of the movie, but she's been hit by a car and is in the process of leaving this plane. Yes.
Oh no. She's calling in Alice and Jenny and Margaret.
A little bit like that, though much more calm and accepting of the situation, I would say. So we get sort of her, the course of her life, and it's done in this really like a style that I haven't really seen quite in this way before. It's almost like a collage where each character seems to be in its own, not just in its own animation style, but almost as if they've come from completely different animated movies, which you would think would be really jarring. And it is a little bit, but it also gives you a sense each character just feels that much more distinct. And it's something you can do in animation and still have it feel like part of the same world. And I think it's also just the other interesting thing to me about it, and this is something that, you know, you mentioned Miyazaki before, Noah, but it's something that I think maybe he doesn't get enough credit for, is that he really embraced, he didn't necessarily just do hand-drawn animation in his career. He embraced digital animation as well, but in a way that combined and interweaved it with more traditional styles of animation.
Yeah.
And I think Damien is doing something similar here with this movie. You know, to have a character like Morona is pretty much traditionally animated 2D, and to have these scenes where all of a sudden she's like swirling in this cosmos that is clearly digitally animated just makes her stand out that much more, and makes her seem much more significant in that space. Which I think is very important for a movie that is about really appreciating this life, which maybe doesn't have a ton of meaning in the grand scheme of things, but to herself, to the people in her life, like her owners and other people that have cared for her, it really is a significant life. And that's just something that you can do by combining all these different styles. It's also a film that doesn't feel the need to abide by normal physics in any way. Like, there, one of her owners is an acrobat, and he's portrayed in this way where, like, he moves very, like in a way where, like, sometimes he's, like, walking on his hands. His body will elongate and just, like, basically fill the entire screen at points. And also he's portrayed in this, like, striped suit. And the stripes in his suit at points will actually, like, leave his suit and become the trapeze from which he's swinging. It's really, like, just so adventurous in its style in a way that I really appreciated. And I think ultimately it's a film that's about, like, very relatable and universal themes of, like, what it is to be needed, what it is to be loved, how heartbreaking it can be to count on people and not have them be there for you when you really need them, or for them to be there in a consistent manner in your life. And I love how the arc of the character as she experiences, you know, some moments of joy, of true affection and love, but also the amount of times that she's betrayed, she becomes more accepting of it over time, which is heartbreaking, but also I think a realistic depiction of the way that you can become sort of acclimated to heartbreak in your life and sort of accept it at a certain point. This is a really moving film. It is, if you are a dog person like I am, it's gonna especially hit you pretty hard.
Whole subgenre, dog cinema.
Yeah, it sounds like a no for me on that alone. Like, I just can't handle sad things happening to dogs in movies too much.
And I will say, yeah, there's not, that's like, it sub, doesn't sub put a genre. Real.
There's dog movies, and then there's sad things happening to dog movies.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't put a ton of emphasis on the actual accident that precipitates this sort of recollection of her life. But yeah, it is, it's the kind of movie that I really encourage people to seek out. I did rent this on Amazon. I couldn't seem to find it streaming anywhere, but I did want to make time for it just because of Zoller Seitz's glowing review. And just of, like, the way that it, I just was, like, fascinated by the way it looked. I'm like, you know, it's a reminder that, like, mainstream animation doesn't really look like this. And it's nice to see, you know, I don't want to slag mainstream animation. I have found much worth and value in things that are much more digitally animated than traditionally animated. But I think something like this, which combines it, it's really nice to know that people are still making movies like this. And so for that reason, I just would really encourage, if you're not a huge fan of animation, I think, to really see what the medium is capable of. I think between this film and The Wolf House, they've just kind of said, like, shown me that, you know, there are people out there, certainly in the international community, who are really still finding ways to show us something we've never seen before. And that is very encouraging. And I hope to be able to financially support those kinds of filmmaking Here's as much as I can, so I don't feel bad about having to rent this one.
Yeah, that sounds cool. I don't know if I'm gonna get to it though, but it sounds like it sounds cool, and I'm glad that you watched it, and I encourage people to take your advice, even though I might not.
All right, well, with that, I am going to actually turn this episode over to our esteemed co-host, Noah France, to discuss Amadeus, which is the movie that he has chosen, winning our Oscar bet. So, Noah, please take it away.
Yes, thank you. So, finally, I finally have an opportunity to come on the show and talk with you guys about my favorite movie of all time. So, for the viewers, so a bit of background information. Amadeus is a 1984 period biographical drama film directed by Milo Forman and starring F. Murray Abraham and Tom Hulce. I have to admit, Wikipedia was not helpful in this regard. They usually have a pronunciation help. Do you guys know if it's Hulce or Hulce?
I thought it was just Hulce.
That's what I thought.
Hulce. That's probably it. So Tom Hulce. So F. Murray Abraham plays the lead character, Antonio Salieri. And Tom Hulce plays Amadeus Mozart, although I think a lot of you would probably be more familiar with him from Disney's animated Hunchback of Notre Dame, because he was Quasimodo in that movie, a fact that I actually found out much, much later. Anyway, so this is a movie that the short version is the plot is about how F. Murray Abraham plays Antonio Salieri, who is a contemporary composer of Wolfgang Mozart's, and becomes so violently, furiously jealous over Mozart's talent compared to his, in his own words, mediocrity, that he decides to take revenge on Mozart and on God, and begins to scheme to find a way to kill Mozart and take credit for at least some of his work. Now, this movie is a direct adaptation of a play with the same story written by Peter Schaefer, which came out in 1979. Fun bit of casting facts. So Peter Schaefer, for those of you who don't know, is, I think, one of the great playwrights of the 20th century. Amadeus is one of his most famous works. He also wrote Equus. And Amadeus came out, was released in London, debuted in London in 1979. And in the original production, Mozart was played by Simon Callow, who appears in this movie, not as Mozart, but as Schikaneder, a friend and colleague of Mozart's. And it then went over to Broadway, where initially the role of Mozart was played by Tim Curry, until he was replaced by Mark Hamill. And I only recently found that out, and it completely blew my mind. They actually apparently were considering casting Mark Hamill for the movie, but this is 1984, so the production was 1983, the year that Return of the Jedi came out. So that's peak Star Wars fame, Mark Hamill. And the director, Milo Forman, was worried that that might kind of overshadow the movie and people would not see Mark Hamill as Mozart. They would just say, oh, look, there's Luke Skywalker. So it's fascinating alternative universe where that casting happened. I would have loved to see what that movie would have been. But I can't say that I'm sad, because this really, like Tom Hulce, this is both he and F. Murray Abraham give career performances in their respective roles. And it's he's a great fit for the role. So this is a movie adapted from Peter Schaefer's play. And Peter Schaefer himself did the adapted screenplay. But the concept of specifically of Antonio Salieri, who was a real-life Italian composer and a contemporary of Mozart's in the Imperial Austrian Empire in Vienna back in the late 1800s, this idea that Salieri,
late 1700s.
What did I say?
Late 1800s.
Oh, sorry, I meant to say 18th century.
Oh, okay.
Sorry about that. So late 1700s, 1780s, 1790s. The idea that Salieri was a jealous opponent of Mozart and that he conspired to kill him, actually, it's not true. Let me just say that up front. This is absolutely not true. In spite of what the poster for this movie on Wikipedia says, I actually just found this out. If you go on the Wikipedia page for Amadeus, it says Amadeus and then the tagline, everything you heard, it's true. Everything you've heard is true. It's not. Salieri did not murder Mozart. But that idea Mozart died under such mysterious circumstances, and we still, to this day, we'll never know exactly what killed him, but it was probably a mixture of disease and drinking. But because he died so young, there were all sorts of conspiracy theories that sprung up. And one of them was that a rival of his, like Salieri, poisoned him. And this idea that Salieri killed Mozart was the basis for a Russian play in 1830, mm-hmm. which then was turned into a Russian opera in 1897. And that opera was made into a silent film in 1917. So there is, like, this movie is not even the second iteration of this idea. It's like the fifth or sixth degree of this theory that Antonio Salieri was so jealous of Mozart that he killed him. But let's just establish this at the beginning. This is not true. There's no historical basis for that. Most historians aren't even certain that the two even actually met and had any sort of personal relationship. But just a fun little bit of background information, I think. So that's the basis of the movie itself. And then the director, Milo Forman, for any of you who do not know, Milo Forman, much like how Peter Schaeffer belongs on any shortlist of, you know, great playwrights of the 20th century, Milo Forman absolutely deserves to be on any shortlist of top film directors of the 20th century. He began his career in the Czech Republic, so he's a Czech director, back when the country was under the control of the Soviet Union. And he had a lot of success there. His Czech language comedy, The Fireman's Ball from 1967, was ranked by Roger Ebert as one of the all-time greatest movies ever made. Then he eventually left and defected to the United States in the early 70s. And in 1975, he had his first significant success with the also classic One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, starring Jack Nicholson. And that movie, in addition, and that movie won him, got him his first Oscar success. He won Best Picture and Best Director for that movie. And then in 1984, he came up with Amadeus, which swept the Oscars that year, won 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. Peter Schaeffer won the Oscar for his adapted screenplay. And F. Murray Abraham and Tom Hulce were both nominated for Best Actor. But F. Murray Abraham actually won. And this is still, I think, easily his most recognizable role. The film was a big hit in general back then, and it's still very well regarded today. And it's still a very popular film. And it's listed, actually, in the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as a film worthy of special efforts to maintain.
Sitting right there next to Armageddon and Shrek.
Well, okay. All right. So there's a lot of really fun history, both behind the story of the film and behind the film itself, which is part of the reason why I love it. But a particular reason why this film is so special for me is has a lot to do with the circumstances under which I first saw the movie. So I first saw this movie in, must have been seventh grade. So I was 11 and a half, 12 years old, 12 and a half, somewhere around then. I can't say exactly when. And that was right at the time where, on the one hand, I was becoming, like, conscious and interested in movies. So I was just starting to develop an interest in and have the ability to talk about, oh, these are my favorite movies and these are the movies that I don't like. That was also the time that I was restarting piano lessons, and I was getting back into playing piano. And in general, that was also the period where I was, like, kind of I developed an awakening interest in music. And that was the first, that was the time in my life where I first developed an interest in, oh, this is the type of music I like, and these are the types of artists that I like. So it was this very formative period in my childhood, where I was developing my interest in movies and in music at the same time that I was also, like, on a personal level, starting to develop my own musical abilities. And then I sit down and watch this classic movie, and my parents are like, oh, no, you're getting into classical music. Here's a movie about Mozart. You'll love it. And so I sit down and watch it. And the first, like, I can still remember the thrill. The movie opens in the future with a very old Salieri crying out into the night about how he is the man who killed Mozart. He's the murderer of Mozart, and he's begging God and Mozart for forgiveness. And a couple of friends go to see what's wrong. And they hear something and they burst into the room and see him as he's in the act of trying to kill himself. Salieri tries to slit his wrists. And his friends immediately catch him in the act and they rush him to the hospital. That's how the film opens. And it has this huge, there's this huge burst of music of one of Mozart's symphonies as they enter into the room and you see Salieri covered in blood. And just the first moment that I saw that, like this thrill, like this chill went through my body. And I was like, oh, wow, this is a thing. Like this is a movie in capital letters. This is a great movie. So it just, I saw this movie at exactly the right time and it made a huge impression on me. And I've watched it. I can't begin to count the number of times I've watched it since then. And it's one of those movies where I only find more to appreciate every time that I go back and revisit it. So the movie hit me at a very formative time in my life. It was one of the first movies that impressed on me just how effective a movie can be, how important lighting is, how important costumes are, how important the use of music and sound is to telling a story. So it's been hugely influential to me as a result. And there are a lot of reasons that I think it still holds up as a great film and has more than earned its reputation. I mean, first and foremost, you have an incredible pedigree behind the screen. You have Milo Forman and Peter Schaefer. So that's just that. That's a match made in heaven. You have incredible acting by all of the cast, I think, not just the two leads, but you especially have these two iconic lead performances. You have these incredible, elaborate sets and costumes. The movie was filmed on site in the city of Prague and back in the 80s. So like before there was any effort to like try and modernize a lot of the city of Prague. So a lot of the city of Prague still looks like it does. Still looks like you see it in the movie. And the famous opera scenes, all the scenes in the opera that are made in the movie were shot in the old opera house in Prague, which is the last standing opera house where Mozart himself performed. So like the members of the cast, when they did interviews afterwards, they talked about how like, oh, we would just walk into the building and you'd feel like this, there'd be the sense of history that would just kind of overwhelmed the set while we were working on. So we knew like, oh wow, we're recreating Don Giovanni on stage where John Giovanni had its world premiere 200 years before. And that really comes across that a very tactile sense of, you know, this is not some gilded, there are a lot of scenes shot in palaces and with fancy dresses and wigs, you know, from European nobility. But it doesn't feel like bright and shiny and clean. Like it's very, it feels tactile and lived in. And that's something else that I grew to appreciate as I got older. It's a very funny movie, especially the first half. It's practically a comedy at times. So a lot of my sense of humor developed from the way this movie uses both, both wordplay and also visual gags to tell jokes. And on an even more personal level, like this was, I was a kid watching this movie and it is a very adult film. So it gave me a sense of like, I'm entering into an adult world when I watch this movie, because it goes deep into a lot of very spiritual and existential questions of, is there a God? What is right and wrong? What is fair? If there's a God, why is there unfairness? Why do some people seem to get ahead and succeed despite being, in some aspects, childish or immature, or maybe not as good as some other people. This sense of jealousy of I'm just capable enough to know that I'm not that good at something, but that other person is way better. So there's that dissonance that I think in any aspect of life can be very potent when you're just good enough at something to know, okay, I'm a little bit capable at doing this thing, but I'm not an expert. And I know when I look at an expert doing it, I know exactly how good they are, because through my own experience, I know that I'm not as good at it. So there's a lot in the role of Salieri that appeals to me in a personal level. And the role of Salieri in this telling of it, both within the movie and within the stage version, is like one of my dream roles that I would just love to imagine myself playing that role someday in the stage version of the show. Maybe it'll happen.
And I still recall back in college when we did a monologue and scene competition, you actually did a couple of excerpts from this film of Salieri.
I did a monologue mashup of a couple of so the movie the setup of the movie is it starts with old Salieri after he tries to kill himself. A priest is sent to him. They say, hey, this guy is crazy. He tried to kill himself and he claims he murdered Mozart. Like, oh, here's confession. Like, try to find out what his deal is. And that is, it is a very jarring opening when you open in the insane asylum and you remember, oh yeah, 18th century, not a very humane place for anyone who is not neurotypical. So the priest goes in and then the rest of the movie is told in flashbacks. Like, it looks like the priest is there for like a whole 24 hours listening to this guy.
It seems even longer. Regurgitate.
Yeah, it seems like an eternity. The priest is just is done by the end of the movie. He is just wrecked.
I mean, I would happily listen to F. Murray Abraham tell me a story for an entire day. So,
I mean, me too. But maybe that's not this priest's cup of tea. So anyway,
he seems into it. I don't know. He seems very engaged.
And so the rest of the movie is then told in flashbacks, and sometimes there's voiceover. So that's the structure of how the movie tells the story of. Of Salieri telling how he allegedly, in air quotes, murdered or caused the death of Wolfgang Mozart. So that's a whole lot of background in the film itself. And that's my background as to why this film made such an impression on me and why I think that it holds up. So I'm going to shut up for just a little bit. And I would say I want to turn it over. Because Justin, you and I have talked about this movie plenty of times before. I know, mm-hmm. I know you love it. Alex, you've just seen this movie for the first time, like a couple days ago.
That is true.
What do you think?
So obviously, I'm watching this film knowing that it's one of your favorite films ever, and so that puts a lot of, you know, that puts it into a certain perspective for me, like in terms of how I'm viewing it. I'm trying to be as respectful as I can when I say that I liked it, but I didn't love it. I thought that F. Murray Abraham's performance is incredible. I think he's so incredibly good. I think that the production design, the costuming, all of that stuff is really great. It's like a very well-made film. Some of the shots and scene compositions and things like that really stand out. I'm a person who really has a lot of respect for Milos Forman as well. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, obviously. Man on the Moon, the Jim Carrey movie, that was a movie that I personally really loved when I was too young to watch it, and I've revisited it since, and it's certainly not as good of a movie as I remember it being, but it still has a special place in my heart, and I have a special affection for Milos Forman, I think, just because of watching the documentary about the making of that film, because my God, did Jim Carrey put him through hell while trying to make that movie.
era of Jim Carrey was this? I forget what year that movie came out.
It was the era of him being a serious dramatic actor, so that kind of narrows it down.
Okay.
It came out in 1999.
He did try.
His best performance, arguably ever, is in a dramatic role, but it's in the one that he's least self-consciously dramatic in, which is, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. But anyway, that's not the movie we're here to talk about today. Instead, we're here to talk about Amadeus, which is a movie that a lot of people like from the 80s, and I think is okay. I have to say, though, you know, the actor who plays Mozart, you know, didn't really go on to do much of anything else after this. He has like a number of credits of things that no one has really ever heard of, and his career just kind of faded. Tom Holtz, and
except for Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Well, sure, but you know, okay. he was in both the Hunchback and the Hunchback sequel and the Hunchback video game. So you know, there's that. But I think Jesus that. Christ. It's not a mistake that he didn't go on to have the strongest career. I didn't think he was perfect at all in this role, and it was a little bit of a distraction for me, honestly. I feel like it's a tough role, to be sure. You know, you have to be able to play kind of the big and the broad and the and the goofy, and also be this kind of this genius composer. And, you know, the movie really puts him through the ringer in terms of just like he is high on the hog and then he is low as low can go. But I don't know, he just kind of like felt like there was a lot of overacting going on in his performance, and it oftentimes felt kind of distracting to me. And that did kind of, you know, limit my ability to really engage with the film as much as I think I was supposed to. Mm-hmm. I just kept thinking, like, imagine if, like, Kevin Kline was in this role, right? Like, I feel like he would have done an excellent job playing all of the notes.
Do you think you would have rather seen Mark Hamill continue this role from the stage
no,
play?
No, definitely not. I think that would have continued my problem with it. Like, I mean, I love Mark Hamill, and he can be used very effectively, but he can also be very hammy and go too big in his performances.
Well,
and
that's why he's one of the best Jokers.
Sure, yeah, that's what I mean. That talent is a skill that can be used well. I think that if it was applied here, it would kind of run into the same sort of problems that I have with Holtz. So, and I think it's tough because he's acting against F. Murray Abraham, giving like one of the best performances of all time, and that's pretty, you know, that contrast is pretty pretty steep. But what I will say is that I thought that the first half of this film I think is great, and I really was engaged. I really love the concept of it, the idea of like channeling this sort of like meeting a person that you admire and realizing that that they're not what you expect them to be, and confronting that idea that's for some people this thing that you really prize yourself on is actually incredibly easy and it just comes naturally to them, and whereas you have to work really hard for it, is a really compelling dramatic idea. And I think that the first half of this film especially really executes that very well. I have to say,
especially that's an aspect where our current internet age, I think that's made this film even more relevant, because modern internet and communications has made it much easier to learn things about, you know, our favorite people and artists that maybe we'd be better off not knowing.
Yeah, well, it's just, I think that, like, what's interesting is part of the Salieri antipathy towards Mozart is that he's such a vulgarian, as he himself describes himself, right? And that is offensive to his principles, Salieri's principles, in a way. But much more so is just the idea that, like, this man just can do this thing, which is compose beautiful music, without seemingly any effort. And that is just infuriating to a person who loves music and cares so deeply about it and puts so much time and effort into it and can't get anywhere near as good as what Mozart can do. And I think that's a very evocative emotion, and I think the first half of this film explores it very well. I think the second half of this film kind of just loses its way a little bit, in my opinion.
Really?
Yeah, I just couldn't really hang with it. Just like, it goes on and on forever, and it's just so clear that what's happening is happening. And I think that Holtz really struggles with the more dramatic stuff in terms of like his fall from grace, you know. It just felt very contrived and cliched in a lot of ways, and I just really never felt the emotional impact that I think I was supposed to feel.
So do you maybe think that this movie, if you had seen the theatrical cut, so just for all those listening, as of right now, at least on most streaming services, the director's cut, which is about a half hour longer, is the only version available. I grew up watching the theatrical cut on a VHS tape. But Alex, kind of, you kind of had no choice.
Watched the director's cut. I looked up later. I looked up later the differences, and I feel like all of the additions, or at least most of the additions, were additive. Like, I think that it was really helpful to understand the relationship Salieri had to Mozart's wife, for instance. I think that matters in the towards the end of the film, knowing that background. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of the additions in the director's cut kind of it amplifies the idea that a part of Salieri's problem with Mozart is this compact that he made with God, and that now he feels like it is kind of, that it was that God is torturing him with Mozart's presence, right? There's a lot more, like, Catholicism in there. And I think that that works to amplify the emotional arc for Salieri. So I don't think that it's certainly longer. It's, you know, it's another almost half hour longer, and definitely I felt the length by the end of the movie. So there's a potential that that could have been a factor, but it seems like all the stuff that was added were things that helped make the story stronger. So I don't know. It would be hard for me to say. I'd have to watch the other version to know for sure, but I don't think that that's what my issue is.
Okay. I have to say, well, Justin, I want to hear your thoughts first, and then I do want to come back to the differences between the theatrical cut and the director's cut.
Well, and before we hear from Justin, I want to pose to both of you, so a big part of the reputation of this movie that I had heard going into it was like, oh, you know, it says that Salieri killed Mozart, but that's not real. This movie doesn't say that, like, at all. Like, I don't know why that's the reputation of the film. That's not what the movie says. The movie is about, like, a man who feels guilt over, like, his wish that this person would die because he feels so insecure about him. But he never actually kills him. He doesn't do anything to kill him. He fantasizes about his death. But that's not the same thing as murdering someone. And I think it's interesting that Solieri's perspective, he's like, oh, I'm responsible for killing him. But, like, he's not. And that's, like, the fact that he thinks that is actually, like, a very interesting question psychologically. But it's weird that the film's reputation kind of takes that as, like, oh, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what happened, but it's not real.
Well,
like, that's not what
happened
even in the movie.
Yeah, I have to say, I think that the movie's own marketing kind of plays a role in that misperception. Like I said, I just earlier today, I took a good look at the poster picture for the film that's on the Wikipedia page, and it says, the man, the music, the madness, the murder, the motion picture, Amadeus, everything you've heard is true. So
isn't that everything is true a reference to Salieri talking about Mozart's skill? Like, I feel like that's lifted from the film itself, and in reference Salieri being impressed by Mozart.
I think the marketing of the film kind of played a role in that, and anyone who didn't actually see the film but had kind of heard of the film by reputation kind of got that association, you know?
Okay.
So I don't think it's entirely
that the film doesn't. Do you agree with me that the film doesn't show that, though? Like, it doesn't show that he's responsible for his death?
No, I think rewatching the movie now, it struck me even more how the movie is very clear about, no, Salieri is full of shit. Like, this is not about, Salieri is not a fallen angel. He was already fallen, and he was just waiting for someone to show him that he'd been kind of an egotistical prick the entire time. He was not some person of virtue. You know, or at least this iteration of Salieri was not some virtuous knight in shining armor, and then Mozart caused him to, like, turn to the dark side. Like, no, he was already there. He had plausible deniability.
Yeah, I'd agree with you in the sense that he's not, he's not physically killing Mozart, although a lot of the film is about him, you know, denying his influence to have Mozart's works performed or to cancel his performances. I think for someone like Salieri, who is so much about the art and the work, that for him, the idea of stifling that work is a kind of murder. And I think there's also this sense, as he talks about manipulating him, using his grief against him, that there's a way, it's more of an indirect sort of thing, but I think that's maybe that's where that's coming from. Not in the sense that he is deliberately, like, legally responsible, but more like emotionally, or like has psychologically or emotionally manipulated this person to the point where he is essentially just wastes away.
Yeah, I think that that's the claim that he's trying to make, but I feel like part of the psychological profile that you're seeing of this man is the idea that, like, he needs to feel connected to Mozart. He needs to feel like he has that he has some level of supremacy over him, and he has failed at that through his whole life. And so the ultimate like ability to assert that is by claiming that he's responsible for his very life ending. You know, that is what I feel like the movie is trying to get at.
Right. And I would say just the fact that even in spite of these claims, the fact that at this point in the movie, Mozart's works are seem to be somewhat well known, like foreboding the reputation that he would grow to have. And so that's even reflected that even in his claim, like he hasn't quite killed him. He hasn't quite killed him the way that he would have liked.
Yeah. And I think that F. Murray Abraham plays all of this stuff incredibly well. Like there's so much nuance in this performance that really helps it land in a way that I really, really appreciate. And it gets you past the old age makeup.
Well, I have to say, I found the old age makeup to still hold up really well. I mean, maybe it's because maybe it was remastered. I think it still holds up. I think it holds up better than most, like, you know, digital aging effects that are done today.
I mean, we've never been particularly good at aging people on film. I, you know, this won an Oscar for makeup, and I'm just like, all right, I don't think it looks particularly good, but okay. It's not the worst instance of aging that I've seen on screen, so, you know. J. Edgar still wins on that one.
Well, that's a movie that had much less of an excuse. Anyway. So I have to say, I think part of that, you know, the whole aspect about Salieri, whether or not Salieri has a role in Mozart's death, I think that also has to do with the way that the movie plays a little bit with the historical record. Because it is true that Mozart more or less dropped dead like halfway through writing his Requiem, which literally means death mass. And he was commissioned to write that death mass by, in air quotes, a dark stranger, as he described it to a friend at the time. And he was also quoted as saying to a friend that he was writing his own Requiem. So there was a certain amount of reality that... Peter Schaefer and then later Milo Forman kind of worked into the narrative of the movie. But it's all there in service of asking these bigger questions. And it is not a movie. It's not a murder mystery. That is not the point. I have to say though, I just want to throw out here this, you know, this big diabolical plan that Salieri eventually comes up with. It's a terrible plan. I mean, it's a terrible plan from the start. And it's kind of obvious that it's not going to work. But what kills it in the end is just the fact that Mozart's wife happened to return, like, right as he died. She wasn't supposed to be there. Like, she tried to leave him. But then she comes back right as he's about to die. And she gets pissed off at Salieri and just locks what's been written of the Requiem into a cabinet. And that's it. That's the end of his plan. It fails. I love the way rewatching it now. I love the way Abraham plays that part where he's just like, no, my plan. And it's just, she just picked up the papers and locked him in a cupboard. That's it. He can in no way claim that work as his own.
Yeah. And it's like a glass. It's like a, you know, what do you call it? Like a glass,
curio.
Yeah. And so he can still see it. It's right there taunting
him. And it's like, what's he gonna do? Is he gonna like steal it? Then the wife is gonna go to court and say, that's not, he didn't write that, he stole it. What's he gonna do? Murder a woman and child to like, and then pretend the death mass is like, no, that's it. It's very, it struck me in this latest rewatching just how hapless Salieri really is. And I do think that the film like fully very, very much plays into that. Like, no, he's not an evil genius. He wasn't any kind of genius to begin with. He's just kind of an egotistical prick. And now he's going to die old and alone.
He's a sad man who thought that God granted him a path in life and then realized that no, life is just random and cruel.
Yeah.
And then he's trying to deal with the reckoning of that for 3 hours.
I think that's a big reason the movie made, like, this was one of the first movies that I watched as a kid that really kind of grappled those questions. And it was one of the first movies that presented those questions to me, you know, like how do you make sense of the randomness and the cruel randomness in a lot of life, you know, when there's
Justin,
no easy
how
answers.
Do you make sense of the cruel randomness?
Okay.
As Sartre once postulated.
I mean, I don't know if I'm prepared to answer that question, but I can tell you my reaction to watching it, as Noah mentioned it before, like, you know, we had seen this, we've talked about this before. I've seen this movie a bunch of times. I first saw it when I was in middle school. I remember it was a big deal. We watched it in a music class, and it was this whole thing. Like, we had to, like, get a I think it's rated PG, right? Am I wrong about that? Or
oh, I don't remember.
The director's cut definitely isn't, because there's a scene where
I know he didn't watch the director's cut. But there was, I just remember it was like a whole big thing. Like, we had to get like our parents to sign a permission slip for it. It was like a whole thing. And
I mean, it starts with a guy slitting his wrist. Like, the opening scene does not pull its punches.
Right. And we were like, I guess I was probably like 12 or 13 at the time.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but like, that scene is a comical scene, though. Like, it's about a man who's slitting his wrists, but who finds him are two guys who are like, come on, don't you want to eat this cake? And like,
yeah, the guy's like an icing mouth. Mustache.
It's not exactly a harrowing introduction, but okay, go ahead, continue.
When you're 12, and like, I was shocked. There was like, my 12-year-old sense was shocked.
Sure, I guess. But, you know, when you're 12, you could be scandalized by a lot of things.
Well, and then it opens up in the insane asylum, and a naked guy runs across, and my 12-year-old self also thought, oh my god, an ass in a movie.
This is where watching movies from a young age definitely affects how you see it, I think, going forward in the rest of your life. But, so it was one of those, like, it was a very unconventional movie for me to watch and then also be a fan of at the time, because at the time I was like, you know, 13-year-old Justin was very into action movies. He liked his Lord of the Rings, James Bond, like, that was kind of his shtick. And this was like very different, but it was like, I feel like it was one of the moments where I was like, oh, this is like a grown-up movie. Like, that, I remember that being my thought at the time. But also at the same time, like, not feeling like my interest flagging, like just being really invested in it in a way that I really hadn't been with films of that type. I definitely had, you know, tried to avoid period pieces of any kind at that time in my life. And so it definitely felt like something new and exciting for me. And over time, like, I've seen it a bunch of times since. I remember at a certain point I read the play. I'm a huge fan of the play. And the play is very different from the movie. And I seem to remember in interviews, Foreman and Schaefer talking about how they had to change a lot of it. Although a lot of it, I got to say, is Foreman talking about changing it and like making it more realistic. I wonder if that was the only approach, or if that was the approach that they knew was going to be sanctioned by the studio. But
making it more realistic in what sense?
In the sense,
well, like,
of,
in
like,
the play version. In the play version, the setup is you, the audience, are spirits from the underworld summoned by Salieri through his occult arts to bear witness to his confession. Like, that's how the play starts.
Yes, and the sense of like having real places, like a lot of the play takes place like on a bare stage, like they're creating things sort of on the fly.
Yeah, there's that too.
There are moments in the play that are, I think, are kind of amazing, where it's almost like you're watching the play, you're watching this psyche just like gradually devolve. At one point, he actually like replays the same scene multiple times, and it gets more and more unhinged. Like, the Mozart in the play version, like, basically becomes a, you know, rabid animal at a certain point. So that just gives you an idea of like what that's going for. And I understand to a certain extent why they couldn't do that in the film, or felt like they couldn't. But that definitely stood out to me more on this viewing, I would say, this idea of like, really, like, even though it is a subjective perspective, we're still like, the way that it's actually depicted feels much more realistic. Like, we're actually watching something that happened, even in moments when Salieri was not present.
Well, and I do think that that's also part of where the movie lost me, is that I think that the first half is really inside of Salieri's perspective, and you're only seeing things when he's seeing things and how he's seeing things. And in the second half of the film, there's a lot of time with Mozart by himself as, like, the lead of the film, and that really just broke the perspective that I thought was so powerful in the first half. I know it's, like, supposed to be conjecture of Salieri's part still, like, he's still the narrator of the story, but it's just, like, it was much more effective when it was coming explicitly from his perspective throughout.
I can see, I can get that.
I just really quick, just to sum up, like, I did say, I would say, like, I really enjoyed it this time. I would also say it, and I might be breaking Noah's heart a little bit by saying this, but it maybe did drop a little bit in my estimation since I had seen it last.
Really?
Okay. I feel like I saw a little bit more of the seams. Part of it might just be like the more, like some of the things that Alex was speaking to. I felt like some of the relationships weren't quite developed enough, didn't quite have the emotional impact that I felt like the film was going for me. And yet there's still just so much about the film that works. Like, I still feel like a huge fan of it. I love the production design. I don't feel like there was, you know, spared no expense, I think, as John Hammond would say. And I just, I love the comedy of it. I think Abraham is just perfect. Like, I just would not want anyone else playing this role. I love him in the scenes where he is basically just like not like attempting to not betray how he actually feels in any moment. There's some of my favorite scenes in any movie of just someone like completely like their smile just completely evaporating in a moment. I just many great scenes of that in this movie.
There are some brutal moments for him where that happens.
Yeah.
The first scene with Mozart on the piano in front of the whole court, like that for me is an all-time favorite movie scene ever for me. Like, that's on my all-time list. Especially the part where the camera just zooms in on Salieri's face as he's getting more and more pissed.
Well, I think the one that I like better is the one where he like has written that like introductory march, like the welcome march, and Mozart hears like it played terribly once and like internalizes it immediately. Oh. It plays it and then makes it better, and it's just
what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's just like an incredible scene of acting from F. Murray Abraham, where it's just like it's just so many emotions and it's also upsetting.
Well, now, I have to say I want to give kudos to all of the like the court figures for really making all of their scenes count. Like, I distinctly remember each and every one, and I love the way that they react to each other. Within that scene, you know, whenever Mozart, like, just says something like, oh, that piece doesn't actually work, and they all just, like, whip their heads around to stare at Salieri, and he just, like, smiles at them, like, yes, okay. Or, like, the two guys who, in addition to Salieri, also end up really hating Mozart. In so many of the opera scenes, they're, like, there's like silent dialogue with just their eyes where they're staring at each other across this opera house and like making hand gestures at each other like they're passing notes or something by the teacher's back. I think it's just absolutely amazing the way that a lot of the smaller characters are able to really characterize and capitalize on their moments and make them count for something.
And like we haven't mentioned Jeffrey Jones because obviously he's, you know, not a great guy who did a lot of bad things in his real life. But he is very effectively comedic in the role of Emperor Joseph II. He gets a lot of really good understated comedic moments that really, really work well. And we can't just ignore that in the review.
No, like, yeah, exactly. So that's like let's state for the record, like Jeffrey Jones is, you know, a sexual offender that came out like a lot later. So I do think it's a case where that should not reflect poorly on this film, especially because he's not the lead role. Like if this was a movie about his character, I think that might be a different story, but he's a comedic side character and he's only in the first half of the movie. So, you know, I feel like you're able to enjoy that for what it is, but then not let that overshadow the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I don't want to praise him too vociferously, but it just he does play a idiot who thinks he's really smart just incredibly effectively in this movie.
Well, and I have to say, like, again, like, I ended up studying history. Joseph II is a very fascinating figure. Like, he is one of the more interesting European monarchs to study, in my opinion. And this performance is one of the things that got me interested in, like, oh, I want to learn more about this Joseph II guy. So, like, that's another way in which the movie, for me, was very formative, not just in terms of my interest in music and movies, but also my interest in history. Was activated because I came away from the movie thinking, oh, I want to know what was true and what wasn't. Like, I want to know about the real Mozart and the real Salieri and the real Joseph II. I have a question for you guys, also related to casting. I want to ask what would the two of you say about Elizabeth Berridge, who plays Mozart's wife? And she was not the original casting. Originally, Meg Tilly was cast to be the wife, and they went all through pre-production and rehearsals with her, but then she had an injury like the day before shooting was set to start, and they had to replace her. I find that interesting because even both when I was a kid and for many years afterwards, I considered Elizabeth Berridge to be one of the like weaker parts of the movie. If you had talked to me when I was 15 or 20 or even 25, I would have said, oh, yeah, great movie, but it's not a perfect movie. You know, Mozart's wife, for example, her performance isn't as good. And there's just a weirdness to her delivery. And she looks out of place and she feels out of place in a lot of scenes. And it's just not that good. And it's probably because she wasn't originally cast in the role. And if Meg Tilly had been in the role, it probably would have been much better. I actually don't think that I would agree with my past self at this point. Like, when I'm revisiting it now, not only do I think that, and to a certain extent, I think the director's cut helps in this sense because she does get a few more very important scenes in the director's cut that establish her character and her motivations. But I do still agree that she does seem a bit different. Her delivery does seem a bit off at times. Like, she seems very befuddled and kind of bemused at Mozart and at Salieri and at their antics. But I found that actually very, very fitting this time around when I watched the movie. Like, it came across to me as like, okay, no, this is a woman who, like, she's a young girl when she meets Mozart and is kind of inexperienced. She is not ready for all of Mozart's bizarre antics and his drinking problems and his weird mental issues. And she is most certainly not ready for, you know, all the power politics bullshit that Salieri is trying to pull. Like, she is out of place with these characters and the bizarre things that they're doing. I feel like I've come to see her performance as much more of a piece with the rest of the movie than I did before. Whereas before, I think I was very eager to dismiss her and her performance. And now revisiting the film this latest time, I actually think that I did her an injustice in that sense. What do you guys think about her and her performance?
Well, I'm not particularly familiar with Meg Tilly. Initially, when you mentioned Meg Tilly, I thought you were talking about Jennifer Tilly, and I got really excited because I think she could have been... I think she's an underrated performer, and I think that would have been a really interesting energy for that role. So I would like to live in the world where that happened instead. I think that this is a not very particularly well-written part, and I think it would have required a very high-caliber actress to make it feel anything less than just, like, the kind of... traditional like love interest role of a genius like figure. Like, it's a lot of just like, I'm caught up in your charisma, oh no, but now I have a kid and I care about responsibility and won't you pay the bills. It's very I think underwritten and leans on those sort of stock cliches about what a wife is. And it's definitely one of my least favorite parts of the movie. And I don't think it's particularly because of the actress. I think it's because of the writing and construction of that character.
Justin, what do you think?
I will say on this viewing, I actually felt like that I felt like the performance worked a little bit better for me. I found her maybe like the most likable character in the movie, to be honest. Like, she's the one who is actually practical, and yet I feel like she's practical in a way where it doesn't feel like the nagging wife stereotype. It feels to me more like someone who acknowledges, who maybe is even able to understand pretty well, like, her husband's antics and how he can't be practical, but also knows how much, like, how hard he works and the toll that it takes on him. And, you know, I appreciated that, and I appreciate that at the same time there is this sense of wanting to, you know, ensure their not just financial security, but their very survival. And yeah, I do think the part is a bit underwritten. I think, you know, I'd be curious to see what another actress would do with this, but I did feel a lot more sympathy for that character. And I also think the film did a really good job just of, really establishing their domestic life. I was, surprised, I think, on this viewing, just like, I was like, oh, I forgot how much time we actually spend in that tiny cramped apartment. You really get to know it pretty well in terms of the geography. There's a way in which, like, I don't know, I almost feel like there's a way in which it works sometimes, like, their relationship, and other times it's just not, you know, it's just not practically survivable. So yeah, I have kind of mixed feelings about it, I guess. I like certain aspects of it. I don't know if it completely escapes the cliche, but I was surprised just how much I felt like I was on her side on this viewing.
It just doesn't seem like she exists as a character outside of, like, being Mozart's wife, you know? And the movie doesn't really feel invested in her at all. It's just kind of like she's there to remind the audience that Mozart is poor and not doing well.
Do you remember, is she present in the stage version at all? Yes. I honestly can't remember.
Yes. She is, but she's present in a way, like, every, like, because of the way that play is constructed, every character feels like they don't really exist on their own. Like, it's all just manifestations of Salieri's psyche.
Okay.
And I feel like that might be like a bit of a flaw of just like the carryover, where here it feels more like, because we're just spending time with them.
Yeah, like there wasn't much to carry over anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that might be part of the issue.
So I wanted to bring that up because I do feel like in my own thoughts about the movie, I was kind of unfair to Elizabeth Berridge before in terms of just dismissing her performance as, oh, the movie is great, except for the wife. She's not that good. So I did want to touch on that. And that also ties into, so much like with when we did our rewatch of Lord of the Rings for this podcast, and I realized upon rewatching that pretty much every edit and twist of the camera had like seared its way into my brain. Very much the same thing has happened with Amadeus. So I made pretty much a point for point list of every single change between the original version and the theatrical cut, which it's been quite a while now since I've actually seen the theatrical version, but it's still up there in my noodle, as Mozart would say. And one of...
Historically, that was his catchphrase.
Yes, this is the historical, the German term is, the German term is noodeln. I have to say, that is something that the movie's portrayal of Mozart does, from what we understand, actually get quite... Like, Mozart was very, very known for being a potty mouth and loving his fart and poop jokes. So that is not that far off the mark, that aspect of Tom Hulce's performance. Anyway, I have to say, I would agree with Alex that for the most part, I find the changes to be either like additive or fine and like inoffensive. There is one exception. There are two scenes related to Mozart being introduced to trying to find another student to help pay the bills. And he's introduced to this like loudmouth, abrasive father who loves his dogs way too much. And that is the one extra part that I think really even the director's cut just did not need, because it stops the movie in its tracks. And also, well, hold on, so there's the first scene with the husband, and then he comes back in another scene in the second part of the movie where the movie is getting darker and more serious, but that scene is very bright. because he's in this large, well-lit white room. And I found it especially disturbing now because the second half of the movie gets, like, the color tone gets darker. A lot more scenes are at night or indoors, and it's more candlelight than there's more candlelight than there is sunlight. But then all of a sudden, for like 2 minutes, you're in this super brilliantly white room. And I found it just like it just brought that the momentum to a screeching halt. So that's the one part that was added in where I was like, you know, Foreman, I would have just left that. I would have tossed that scene and just not. You didn't need it.
That's interesting. I actually so what I would say is if you are trying to cut things out of the movie, I could understand why you would take out those two scenes because they do feel somewhat extraneous in a world where you need to get the movie under 3 hours. But I like their presence in the film because in the first, because the first scene, it's like, it's showing, like the indignities that he is refusing to endure, right? In that moment where he thinks that he's better than this. And then it works, like it maybe goes on a bit too long, maybe is a bit too broad, in that intro scene where like you establish that, but it works because of that second scene, like when you go back to it, because you see where he's fallen, that he's actually willing to go back
even that idiot, to this like person. Even that idiot is not willing to give him the time of the day.
Yeah, and it's reflective of like what his life is like, and also just how completely inattentive he is to like the passage of time, to because it's like, oh, like he thinks that he could still tutor this man's daughter who was presented as like, you know, a teenager at the time and now is like married off and doesn't even live in the city anymore. So like he's just completely so disconnected from this like upper crust that he has no concept of the fact that like this wouldn't even be a possible like option for him to return to. So I thought that it was very useful in that way. And like, I know that aesthetically you're right. It is a brighter room, but I think that that's kind of purposeful because he's revisiting a point in his past. Right. So he's going back to that space and it's not there for him anymore. I think that works.
I get what you're saying. I mean, here's the thing. This is a movie taking place in Europe with all these European characters. Obviously, this is overwhelmingly an American cast, maybe with a few exceptions. That father, that dad in that scene, I'm just like, oh my God, he's so fucking American. It really bothered. And like, that was my reaction. It's like, he's too American for this movie. Get him out.
I will say that in the first of those two scenes, like it's just like a sonic assault though, in a way that was very unpleasant between like the loud piano music and all the dogs barking and yelling and the fight and the people. It was a lot. And
that's the point, but it's like, so the one, I do have to say the one part, the two things that the director's cut adds that I think are of the most value are the scene at like the party out in town where Salieri happens across Mozart and his wife and Mozart's father. They add a few extra shots to that scene that make it very clear that Salieri sees Mozart's dad in this dark costume and recognizes that it's Mozart's dad to better explain the fact that Salieri chooses that disguise as his means to like torment Mozart later on. I had no problem understanding, like making the connection to my brain as a kid. I do think it's worthwhile though that the director's cut would like pad out that scene just enough to make that make a little bit more sense. And as Alex has pointed out, and this is a scene that is in the stage version, where in an effort to try to be more controlling of Mozart, Salieri toys with the idea of seducing Mozart's wife. Mm-hmm. Either like to make Mozart a cuckold or like, I guess it depends on how you could depending on how you stage the play, you could interpret it as, oh, he actually did want to seduce her, but then like backs away at the last second, or nah, he was just messing with her from the start. Like I think you could play it both ways depending on how you want to do the scene. And so that scene, they filmed that scene, but they cut it from, the theatrical cut. So between that initial scene where Salieri and Mozart's wife meet, there's nothing between them all the way up until the very end where she happens across him, like sleeping very awkwardly in her son's bed. It's great, smooth wake-up move there by Salieri as he stumbles out of a child's bed.
Yeah, and I have to say, I think, like, it's interesting that you keep using the term seduction. I don't know if that's necessarily appropriate, because he's not at any point trying to seduce her. Yeah,
that's a good point.
I think that the way that F. Murray Abraham plays it in the sequence is that he realizes that he can assert this power over Mozart's wife in a way that that gives him power over Mozart. It's an indulgence that he makes in the moment that he kind of immediately regrets and can't and is just desperately hoping that the wife won't follow through on it. And then when she appears, he's willing to go along with it. He's so ashamed of himself that he forces her out. And I think, like, that's definitely the way that he portrays it. And I think that that's interesting in terms of just, like, being a person who feels so out of control, and he suddenly has this authority over these people, and, like, this moment of weakness, he indulges in it in a really, really dark way, and then pulls himself back from it.
Well,
it kind of
speaks,
it kind of previews sort of what what his arc is going to be in the future of the film, you know?
Yeah. And that scene as well includes when she, like, undoes her dress and her dress hits the floor. That scene includes a music drop of, I think it's the first movement of the Requiem. I'd have to double check the scene again.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it does a music drop with one of Mozart's heavier, darker pieces of music. So it provides another example of, you know, again, one of the things about the movie that had the biggest impression on me was the way it uses its music drops to establish tone or to shift from one scene to another. But all in ways that emphasize what the music itself was originally meant to convey. Whether it's happy, cheerful music, or slow and somber, or beautiful, or tragic, or dark. I mean, just, there are so many moments in this movie that for me are, like, all-time greatest movie moments. And another one of them is at the very end when Mozart dies and is buried, and you get the very last amen of the Lacrimosa from his death mass, and you cut from his corpse in a pauper's grave, where, you know, and Mozart was buried in a mass grave, just totally undignified, just his body's in a sack, and it cuts from that to the crucifix, it being clutched by the priest, and his eyes are just like, my world has been destroyed. I know there is no God. I think that's an all-time great transition in a movie. It's just, I mean, the good stuff in the movie is just so fucking good.
Yeah. I just really quick wanted to go back to the scene that you were talking about with Costanzi, because the one where she intends to go through with his proposition. I remember, like, that's one of the few scenes I do remember from the director's cut. And when I watched it this time, especially toward the end, like around the time when she locks the Requiem in the cabinet, it made that interaction play a lot differently than if that had not been in the movie. There's a kind of formality that she adopts in that moment, which is very telling. There's also just the strangeness of the situation that she finds Salieri and her husband, like, you know, sleeping in the same room. But, like, it really does make that play a lot differently. So, yeah, I can definitely see that being something that would definitely add to the movie. And like you mentioned, it is in the play as well.
Do you guys have any like bigger thoughts on the movie that you want to share that we haven't touched on already?
Justin, what is your biggest thought in relation to this film?
Biggest thought.
the biggest.
I love how this movie depicts music. It gets at something like, I don't know if this is something that everyone can relate, you know, certainly for myself, you know, where music seems to transcend itself as a kind of artificial creation. It becomes something more, something divine. And just that like sense of, how could this be anything but divine? Like, it's just, it touches a part of you. It, you know, wrenches itself inside your core. in a way that is like sometimes just totally unexplainable, that just you can't even quite articulate why it moves you in such a way. It just does. And I think this film really depicts that. Part of it is through the music itself, which, you know, when you're working from Mozart, you know, kind of a good starting place. And part of it is also just Abraham's reactions to it. I think one of my favorite scenes in the movie
when he's flipping through the manuscripts.
Yeah. And the way he does it is so perfect, because it's almost like every time he opens it, it's like this new miracle and also this new like devastation for him.
Yeah.
Like the fury with which he opens and closes that portfolio of the music. And then the ultimate moment where he basically orgasms.
it's orgasmic for sure.
It's so perfect. And it's so brilliantly undercut by just like the sound of the papers dropping unceremoniously on the floor. And Stanzi saying, like, is it not good? So I love the way this depicts music. It gets to a point where I can understand to a certain extent this notion of creating music and it being this divine thing that is beyond sort of human understanding, that really speaks to something that is deeply spiritual. And, you know, I think as a result, it just hits you on a level that I think the best music, you know, that only the best music can.
Yeah, I think that's a way in which this movie is head and shoulders above a lot of other movies about musicians and or the art of making music. Like, I think this movie gets at something that a lot of those movies want to get at, but can't really pull off. Because it's hard to visually depict music in a movie, you know?
Yeah.
You have to know exactly what you're doing. And if you're just doing music drops for the sake of music drops, then that's not the same thing as understanding why that music is so effective and working it into the film itself. Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like movies are very well suited to show what's great about music. And there's like a lot of famous instances of that, including many of the best musicals, you know, but I guess it's in most of those cases, it's not about people who love music and why they love it. It's more of just like presenting music and in a emotionally evocative way that gets inside of you. But it doesn't. It's not textually about how music does that. So this movie definitely is that. And understand why it ends up being taught in music classes across middle schools. It's like this and like Mr. Holland's Opus, right? Like those are the two go-tos.
Oh, gosh.
All right, Alex, what is your big thought?
My big thought is that I get why people like this movie. It definitely has a lot of the trappings of a movie that would be capital G great. I wish that I liked it more than I did, but I didn't hate it, and I'm glad to have experienced it.
All right. So I have, on a somewhat lighter note, I have a question for you guys. So another reason that I love this movie is, and I said this before, this movie is so fucking funny at some points, especially in the first half. And it also has, I also love movies that have a lot of quippy writing, like that is kind of a weakness of mine. And this movie is one of the, I think one of the, just one of the best movies to just quote in other contexts of all time. So do either of you guys have a favorite quote from the movie?
No.
I mean, I've got so many.
All right, pick your top three, Justin.
I mean, one of the ones that comes to mind is Salieri asking Mozart what he thought of his opera, and the way in which he's able to, you know, I think Salieri is aware that he's insulting him, but like no one else really is. Like, I think it just works so brilliantly with the, you know, I didn't know music like that was possible. One hears such sounds and what can one say but Salieri. And I really do love Holst's delivery of that, because it's so sort of upbeat and like just that much more cutting as a result.
I don't have a favorite quote, but I will say that I enjoyed reading a lot of people's Letterboxd reviews of Amadeus, and a writer that I really like, Fran Hoffner, has a line in her review where she says that she's talking about the film, and then she says, "But I am Salieri in my desire to always eat a little cookie before being rude," and I think that that's a nice little trait that Salieri has, and because I hadn't quite noticed that as a thing while watching it, but once she said that in her review, I was like, okay, he literally does always eat like a little sweet treat before being an asshole to somebody in a scene.
No, that's also from the play. Like, the play establishes, oh, I'm obsessed with sweets. So I have to say, we talked about Geoffrey Jones earlier. My two all-time favorite, I think for me, the two all-time funniest moments in the movie are, first off, when he happens to go into a rehearsal of The Marriage of Figaro after some of the court members have tried to force Mozart to take out some of the music.
And there's a scene of him in the dance scenes.
Yeah,
in the ballet.
Dance scenes. For reasons that are not important to rehash. So there are these dancers like trancing across stage, but there's no music. And he just stares at it for a second, then I don't understand. Is it modern? That line kills me every time. And I use it all the time for so many things. And anytime he says the line, well, there it is.
That is particularly funny.
It's literally his get out of jail free card. Like something super awkward just happened. Well, there it is. All right, I'm off to meet the Queen of France. So I counted. I actually counted this time. That line is uttered 5 times. I actually thought it was more than that, but it was only 5 times. There is exactly 5 times in the movie.
My favorite time is when it's like they're on stage after the performance and like the woman faints.
And
he uses that as his, like, all right, well, I guess we're done here. Like,
and the lead up to that, oh, Majesty, you give such royal advice. And he's just kind of like waiting for it. Like, that scene continues like that in the theatrical version. That's basically the end of the scene. But in the director's cut, it continues on a bit. I kind of wish they'd left that scene as is, because I think it's more effective that way. But that's a nitpick on my part. So, all right. So thank you. Well, thank you to all of you for listening. Thank you to you two for indulging me and indulging my love of sweets, specifically the sweets, the Roman chestnuts that are this movie.
Venus you sent us were a bit excessive, but I did partake anyway.
My reaction was the same.
Jared Leto told me that's the best way to do a podcast. And if Jared Leto does it, it has to be the right way, right? Anyway, I do want to say something. I do want to sort of, because this is a movie that there's a lot of like existential angst that this movie like uses and evokes. I do want to wrap up on a somewhat positive note. So in a metaphorical level, even though Salieri did not kill Mozart and did not hate his guts or anything like that, and there was no effort by either composer to like one up the other, it is true that Salieri did kind of end up forgotten for quite a while. Like in the late 1800s and for most of the 20th century, he was not really like, no one really recorded or like performed his music. And he was not he certainly wasn't spoken of in the same level as like, oh, the classic composers, Bach, Mozart, Strauss, Beethoven. Like he just kind of fell off the wayside. But partly as a result of this movie's popularity and success, there, like, the past couple decades has seen like a big upswing in like on it. Like there are a lot of historians and musical historians who've gone back and kind of rediscovered a lot of the true story behind Salieri and Mozart and what little interaction they may have had. And Salieri has seen like an upswing in a lot of people like rediscovering his music, and there are more companies now who are performing his music. So like that's one positive influence that this movie has had, even though it's historical fiction and it makes a very, very unflattering portrayal of this real life figure. Like one of the ripple effects of that has been a renewed appreciation. What?
I don't think this is unflattering at all. I think that he's an incredibly relatable character who you walk away from this film being like understanding deeply. And okay, I think that is partially why he's had such a renewed interest as a result.
Well, like, because the movie does kind of, at least within the text of the movie, it does kind of lean of, oh, he wasn't part of the reason why he became so jealous is that he really wasn't that good of a musician to begin with. And that genuinely is not true. So like one of the ripple effects of this movie's success has been a renewed interest over the past couple decades and kind of a mini rediscovery and revival of someone whose career and work, whose real life career and work very much is worth your time. So if nothing else, if you've seen this movie and don't like it, or if you're not convinced that you should see the movie, at any rate, you should take the time. I mean, of course, you should also appreciate the music and legacy of Mozart, but also take the time to check out the music of Antonio Salieri as well. He is not as well known as Mozart, but maybe it's time that should change. So I think that should be, I think that that's a good positive note to end on in our discussion of the film.
Sure. Yeah. My positive note is that I like that they make the decision to have the Italians have British accents and the Germans have American accents. I thought that was an interesting choice.
Just like Operation Valkyrie.
So one bit of trivia just before we end here. One thing I did want to add. In the vaudeville of Mozart's operas, there's a character who talks about how he's sick to death of that tune. Does anyone know who that actor is?
No.
That is Kenny Baker, a.k.a. R2-D2.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
Oh, okay. I saw that he was in the casting.
Wow. We got two Star Wars tie-ins today. Yeah. That's a wrap, folks.
So just wanted to mention that.
Oh, no. Actually, Justin, you reminded me of this. Also, another fun fact. In the original, or was it the Broadway production or the London production, Salieri was played by Ian McKellen.
Broadway production.
The Broadway production. So another...
That'd be pretty... I mean, F. Murray Abraham is as good as you could be, but I would like to see what Ian McKellen would do in that role.
It's... I would love to see... I would love to pop into an alternate universe where you have Ian McKellen and Mark Hamill revising these roles for the film. just to see what it'd
also,
be like.
Also, like, okay, so not to be bitchy, but how old is everyone supposed to be over the course of this film? Like, I was very confused by this. Because it's like... my understanding is that, like, Mozart is supposed to be slightly younger than Salieri, right? But, like, and we're supposed... But, like, when the film starts, like, Mozart is, like, in his late 20s or early 20s? And Salieri is, like, 30 or, like, 50? Like, what's going on?
No, okay, so the time period takes place in the 1780s, basically, because Mozart died at the age of 35 or 36 in 1790. So it's like the 1780s is the decade, and he says specifically that he's 26 when he first comes to Vienna. So theoretically, we're seeing 9 years go by.
And Salieri is supposed to be how old during that time?
It's not specified, like 30s, maybe, I would say. Maybe 40.
Okay.
Not that much older, though, because he did say that he was, you know, a teenage kid hearing about Mozart the Child Prodigy. So he's maybe supposed to be early to mid-30s.
Yeah, like, my sense is that he's supposed to be, like, 10 years older than Mozart.
Something like that. Young enough that he can still be in lust with his students. But he's totally chaste, guys. He's a model of virtue. He really is.
Of course. Yeah. Until he realizes that there's no God, and then all bets are off.
Well, and that's okay, I have to say that's another moment. Him burning the cross was another, like, that made a big impression on me at a young age, like seeing like just the weight of that scene. And that's carried through his performance. But no, man, go watch it, everyone. If nothing else, see it for F. Murray Abraham.
Yeah, if I think there's anything we can all three of us agree on is that this movie is definitely worth your time.
Oh, yeah, that's the reason. Yeah. Like, is it one of the best films of the 80s? For me, no, it's not. But F. Murray Abraham's performance is definitely one of the best performances of the 80s, for sure. And that's worth watching for that alone.
And I want to thank Noah for letting us, well... for having us, letting us discuss it. Yeah, forcing us to discuss it. good stuff. Okay. So we'll wrap it up there and let's talk about where we can find everyone. And we'll start with you, Noah.
Well, in addition to my work here, you guys should all check out the podcast that Justin and I did for the Pop Break called Pod on the Rooftops, where we go through literally every album that the band Genesis made, speaking of religious undertones.
I'd say overtones.
Very overtly overtones.
They're called Genesis.
Yes. And the first album is called From Genesis to Revelations. Anyway, and then in addition to that, you should check out all of my written stuff on my blog at francenoir.blogspot.com.
Yes, I just had the great pleasure of reading your piece on Eurovision, which is something I still feel like I barely understand.
I had fun.
Yes, that much is very clear. As for me, you can find my work at thecinemaverick.com. That is my website. You can also find me on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick, where I have been slowly updating all the 2020 movies that I am almost finished with. I'm doing a little better than I was last year, so we'll see.
I think by the time this episode posts, you'll be done with your 2020.
By Labor Day. Deadline is Labor Day.
I'm hoping sometime this month, but we'll see. I don't want to get my hopes up. Anyway.
A 2021 month, Justin, or a 2020 month, where it's actually like 10 months?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I think
ignore me.
World moved slower in the year 2020.
I see. Yeah. It might be closer to a 2020 thing, just knowing my luck. But so you can find me there. And like Noah mentioned, we are on the Pop Break Pod on the Rooftops. That's probably the best place to find us. And let's go to you, Alex.
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter at Media Thinkings and on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. Over there, I have a lot of lists. You could check out our Cinema Joes podcast list, where I have every movie that we reviewed, that we gave a featured review to on the podcast, is listed over there. Also, if you want to see my best films of the 80s list to see which movies I liked better than Amadeus, you could check that out over there. You can also follow my work as podcast editor of popbreak.com. We have two podcast feeds that you could subscribe to. The Breakcast feed, which is a general culture podcast that we have different podcasts about wrestling and about music and movies and manga. You can check that out on all major podcast platforms. You could also subscribe to Pop Break TV, where I host a show once a month called TV Break, where we break down the ins and outs of the TV world. And that's kind of the flagship of that podcast feed, but we also have lots of other ones in there talking about reality shows, different types of blurdy, nerdy content, anniversaries, all the rest of that kind of stuff. If you like The Bachelorette, we have a weekly coverage of that show with our Roses and Rejections team. So definitely check out all that stuff as well. And for Cinema Joes, you can follow Cinema Joes at Cinema Joes on Twitter, and Cinema Joes on all major podcast platforms. Subscribe to us, please.
Yes, I would highly encourage that. I really enjoyed listening to a lot of different podcasts on the Pop Break, not just my own. Well, thank you for that. And we want to thank all of our listeners and all of our subscribers for continuing to stick with us. Be on the lookout for more great stuff to come this year. But for now, this is Justin Mancini for the Cinema Joes, signing off.